page 121, last chapter, or last paragraph. It has already been said above that even this region cannot be called pure spirit land in the full sense of the word. This is the case because the stage at which men have left civilization on earth continues to influence their spiritual existence. They can enjoy in spirit land only the fruits of what it was possible for them to carry out in accordance with their talents and the stage of development of the folk, state, and nation into which they were born. In the still higher regions of the spirit land, the human spirit is now freed from every earthly fetter. It rises to the pure spirit land in which it experiences the intentions, the aims, that the spirit set itself to accomplish by means of the earthly life. All that has been already realized in the earthly world brings into existence only a more or less weak copy of the highest intentions and aims. Each crystal, each tree, each animal, and all that is being realized in the domain of human creation, all this gives only copies of what the spirit intends, and man during his incarnations can only link himself with these imperfect copies of the perfect intentions and aims. Thus during one of his incarnations, he himself can only be an image of what, in the kingdom of the spirit, he is intended to be. What he really is as spirit in spirit land comes therefore into view only when he rises to the fifth region of spirit land in the interval between two incarnations. What he is here is really he himself, the being who receives an external existence in the numerous and varied incarnations. In this region, the true self of man can freely live and expand in all directions, and this self is thus the being who appears ever anew in each incarnation as the One. This self brings with it the faculties that have developed in the lower regions of the spirit land. It consequently carries the fruits of former lives over into those following. It is the bearer of the results of former incarnations. When the self lives in the fifth region of the spirit land, it is in the kingdom of intentions and purposes. Just as the architect learns from the imperfections that have come to light in his work, and just as he brings into his new designs only what he was able to change from imperfections to perfections, so does the self in the fifth region discard from the results of its former lives whatever is bound up with the imperfections of the lower worlds, and with these results it impregnates the purposes of the spirit land, purposes with which it now lives. It is clear that the force that can be drawn from this region will depend upon how much the self, during its incarnation, has acquired in the form of results fit to be taken up into the world of purposes. The self that has sought to realize the purposes of the spirit during earthly life through an active thought life or through wise love expressed in deeds will establish a strong claim upon this region. The self that has expended its efforts entirely on the events of everyday life, that has lived only in the transitory, has sown no seeds that can be fruitful in the purposes of the eternal world order. Only the small portion of its activities that extended beyond the interests of everyday life can unfold as fruit in these higher regions of the spirit land. It must not be supposed that what comes into consideration here is chiefly earthly fame or anything akin to it. No, the important thing to realize here is that in the narrowest walks of life, even the least event has its significance in the eternal progressive course of existence. We must make ourselves familiar with the thought that in this region our judgments must be different from those in the physical life. For instance, if a man has acquired little that is related to this fifth region, the craving arises in him to imprint an impulse upon himself for the following life that will cause that life to run its course in such a way that in its destiny or karma the corresponding effect of that deficiency will come to light. Experiences which in the following earth life appear as a painful destiny, seen from that life and perhaps deeply bewailed as such, are nevertheless the very experiences that a man in this region of spirit land finds absolutely necessary for himself. Since a man in the fifth region lives in his own true self, he is lifted out of everything from the lower worlds that envelops him during his incarnations. He is what he ever was and ever will be during the course of his incarnations. He lives in the governing power of the intentions that prevail during these incarnations, and that he grafts into his own self. He looks back on his own past and feels that all he has experienced in it will be brought into service in the intentions he has to realize in the future. There flash forth a kind of remembrance of his earlier and a prophetic vision of his future lives. We see, therefore, that what we call in this book spirit self lives in this region, as far as it is developed, in the reality that is appropriate to it. It develops itself still further and prepares itself to make possible, in a new incarnation, the fulfillment of the spiritual intentions in the realities of earthly life. If during a succession of sojourns in spirit land, the spirit self has evolved so far that it can move about quite freely there, it will evermore seek there its true home. Life in the world of spirit will be as familiar to it as life in physical reality is to the earthly man. The viewpoints of the spirit world operate from now on as the dominating ones, which it makes its own more or less consciously or unconsciously for its succeeding earth lives. The self can feel itself to be a member of the divine world order. The limitations and laws of the earthly life do not affect it in its innermost being. Power for all that it carries out comes to it from this spiritual world. The spiritual world, however, is a unity. He who lives in it knows how the eternal has worked creatively upon the past. Out of the eternal, he can determine the direction for the future. See Addendum 12. His view over the past widens into a perfect one. The man who has reached this stage sets before himself aims that he intends to carry out in a coming incarnation. From out the spirit land, he influences his future so that it runs its course in harmony with the true and spiritual. Such a person during the stages between two incarnations finds himself in the presence of all those exalted beings before whose gaze divine wisdom lies spread out unveiled, because he has climbed up to the stage at which he can understand it. In the sixth region of the spirit land, a man will fulfill in all his actions what is most in accord with the true being of the world. He cannot seek after what profits himself, but only after what ought to happen according to the right course of the world order. In the seventh region of the spirit land, the limit of the three worlds is reached. Man stands in the presence of the life kernels, which are transplanted from higher worlds into the three already described, in order that in them they may fulfill their tasks. When a man has reached the boundary of the three worlds, he recognizes himself in his own life kernel. This implies that for him, the problems of these three worlds have been solved. He has a complete view of the entire life of these worlds. In physical life, the powers of the soul, through which it obtains the experiences in the spiritual world here described, remain unconscious under ordinary circumstances. They work in their unconscious depths upon the bodily organs, which bring about the consciousness of the physical world. That is precisely the reason why these powers remain imperceptible for this world. The eye, too, does not see itself, because forces are at work in it that make other things visible. If one would judge to what extent a human life running its course between birth and death can be the result of preceding earth lives, one must take into consideration the fact that a point of view that lies within this same life, and at the outset is the natural one, can yield no possibility of correct judgment. For such a point of view, for instance, an earth life could appear full of suffering, imperfect. Yet seen from an extra-earthly viewpoint, this very configuration of the earth life, with its suffering, its imperfections, would prove to be the result of previous earth lives. By treading the path of knowledge, as this is described in the next chapter, the soul sets itself free from the conditions of bodily life. Thus it can perceive in a picture the experiences that it undergoes between death and the new birth. Perception of this kind makes it possible to describe what happens in spirit land, as has been done here in but little more than outline. Only when we do not neglect to hold before our minds the fact that the whole disposition of the soul is different in the physical body from its disposition during purely spiritual experiences, only then shall we see the description given here in the right light. Number 5. The physical world and its connection with the soul and spirit land. The formations in the soul world and in spirit land cannot be the objects of external sense perception. The objects of this sense perception are to be added as a third world to the two already described. Man lives during his bodily existence simultaneously in the three worlds. He perceives the things of the sensory world and acts upon them. The formations of the soul world act upon him through their forces of sympathy and antipathy, and his own soul excites waves in the soul world by its likes and dislikes, desires and wishes. The spiritual being of things, on the other hand, mirrors itself in his thought world, and he himself, as thinking spirit being, is a citizen of spirit land, and a companion of all that lives in that region of the world. This makes it evident that the sensory world is only a part of what surrounds us. This part stands out from our general surrounding with a certain independence, because it can be perceived by senses that disregard the soul and spiritual parts. These, however, belong just as much to this surrounding world as does the material part. Just as a piece of floating ice is substance of the surrounding water, although it stands out prominently owing to particular qualities, so are the things perceptible to the senses substance of the surrounding soul and spirit worlds. They stand out from these worlds owing to particular qualities that make them perceptible to the senses. They are, speaking somewhat metaphorically, condensed spirit and soul formations, and the condensation makes it possible for the senses to acquire knowledge of them. In fact, just as ice is only a form in which water exists, so are the objects of the senses only a form in which soul and spirit beings exist. If this can be grasped, if this has been grasped, it can also be understood that as water can pass over into ice, so the spirit world can pass over into the soul world, and the soul world into that of the senses. Looked at from this point of view, it can be seen why we can form thoughts about the things of the senses. Thus there is a question that everyone who thinks must ask himself. Quote, in what relation does the thought that we have about a stone, stand to the stone itself? Unquote. This question rises in full clearness in the minds of those persons who look with especial penetration into external nature. They feel the consonance of the human thought world with the structure and order of nature. The great astronomer Kepler, for example, speaks in a beautiful way about this harmony. He says, quote, true it is that the divine call that bids man study astronomy stands written in the world, not indeed in words and syllables, but factually, by virtue of the adaptability of the human senses and concepts to the concatenations of the heavenly bodies and conditions. Unquote. Only because the things of the sensible world are nothing but condensed spirit beings is the man who lifts himself by means of his thoughts to these spirit beings able by thinking to understand the things. Sense objects originate in the spirit world. They are only another form of the spirit beings, and when a man forms thoughts about things, his inner nature is merely directed away from the sensible form and out towards the spiritual archetypes of these things. To understand an object by means of thought is a process that may be likened to the liquefaction of a solid body by fire, in order that the chemist may examine it in its liquid form. The spiritual archetypes of the sense world are to be found in the various regions of the spirit land. In the 5th, 6th, and 7th regions, these archetypes are still found as living germ points. In the 4 lower regions, they shape themselves into spiritual structures. The human spirit perceives a shadowy reflection of these spiritual formations when by thinking it tries to gain understanding of the things of the senses. How these formations have condensed until they form the sense world is a problem for the seeker who strives towards a spiritual understanding of the world around him. For human sense perception, this surrounding world is divided primarily into 4 distinctly separate stages: the mineral, plant, animal, and human. The mineral kingdom is perceived by the senses and comprehended by thought. Thus, when we form a thought about a mineral body, we have to do with 2 things, the sense object and the thought. Accordingly, we must imagine that this sense object is a condensed thought being. Now, one mineral being acts on another in an external way. It impinges on it and moves it. It warms it, lights it up, dissolves it, and so forth. This external kind of action can be expressed in thoughts. We form thoughts about the way mineral things act on each other externally in accordance with law. By this means, our separate thoughts expand into a thought picture of the whole mineral world. And this thought picture is a reflection of the archetype of the whole mineral world of the senses. It is to be found as a complete whole in the spirit world. In the plant kingdom, the phenomena of growth and propagation are added to the phenomenon of external action of one thing or another. The plant grows and brings forth from itself beings like itself. Life is here added to what confronts us in the mineral kingdom. The simple recollection of this fact leads to a view that is enlightening in this connection. The plant has the power to create its living shape and to reproduce it in a being of its own kind. In between the shapeless character of mineral matter as we meet it in gases, liquids, etc., and the living shape of the plant world, stand the forms of the crystals. In the crystals we have to seek the transition from the shapeless mineral world to the plant kingdom that has the capacity for forming living shapes. In this externally sensory formative process in both kingdoms, mineral and plant, we must see the sensory condensation of the purely spiritual process that takes place when the spiritual germs of the three higher regions of the spirit land form themselves into the spirit shapes of the lower regions. The transition from the formless spiritual germ to the formed structure corresponds in the spiritual world to the process of crystallization. This transition is the spiritual archetype of the process of crystallization. If this transition condenses so that the senses can perceive it in its outcome, it then exhibits itself in the world of senses as the process of mineral crystallization. There is, however, also in the plant being a fashioned spirit germ. Here the living fashioning capacity is still retained in the shaped being. In the crystal, the spirit germ has lost its constructive power during the process of fashioning. It has exhausted its life in the shape produced. The plant has shape, and in addition it has the capacity to produce a shape. The characteristic belonging to the spirit germs in the higher regions of the spirit land has been preserved in the plant life. The plant has, therefore, form like the crystal, and to that is added the shaping or formative force. Besides the form that the primal beings have assumed in the plant shape, there is another form working on that shape that bears the impress of the spirit beings of the higher regions. Only what manifests itself in the completed shape of the plant, however, is sensibly perceptible. The formative beings who give life to this shape are present but imperceptible in the plant kingdom. The physical eye sees the lily, small today and sometime later sees it grown larger. The formative force that evolves the latter out of the former is not seen by this eye. This formative force being is the part of the plant world that acts imperceptibly to the senses. The spirit germs have descended a stage in order to work in the kingdom of shapes. In spiritual science, elementary kingdoms are spoken of. If we designate the primal forms, which have as yet no shape, as the first elementary kingdom, then the force beings who work invisibly to the senses as the craftsmen of plant growth may be designated as belonging to the second elementary kingdom. In the animal world, sensation and impulse are added to the capacities for growth and propagation. These are manifestations of the soul world. A being endowed with these belongs to the soul world, receives impressions from it, and reacts on it. Now every sensation and every impulse that arises in the animal is brought forth from the foundations of the animal soul. The shape is more enduring than the feeling or impulse. One may say that the life of sensation bears the same relation to the more enduring living shape that the self-changing plant shape bears to the rigid crystal. The plant exhausts itself to a certain extent in the shape-forming force. During its life, it continues to add new shapes to itself. First it sends forth roots, then its leafy structure, later flowers, and finally its fruit and seeds. The animal is enclosed within a shape complete within itself, and develops within this the changeful life of feeling and impulse. This life has its existence in the soul world. The plant grows and propagates itself. The animal feels and develops its impulses. They constitute for the animal the formless that is always developing into new forms. They have their archetypal processes ultimately in the highest regions of spirit land, but they carry out their activities in the soul world. There are thus in the animal world, in addition to the force beings, who invisible to the senses direct growth and propagation, others who have descended a stage deeper into the soul world. In the animal kingdom, formless beings who clothe themselves in soul sheaths are present as the master builders, bringing about sensations and impulses. They are the real architects of the animal forms. In spiritual science, this region to which they belong may be called the third elementary kingdom. Man, in addition to having the capacities named in plant and animal,
is furnished also with the power of elaborating his sensations into ideas and thoughts, and of controlling his impulses by thinking. The thought, which appears in the plant as shape, and in the animal as soul force, makes its appearance in man in its own form as thought itself. The animal is soul, man is spirit. The spirit being, which in the animal is engaged in soul development, has now descended a stage deeper still. In the animal it is soul forming. In man it has entered into the world of sensory matter itself. The spirit is present within the human sensory body, and because it appears in a sensory garment, it can appear only as the shadowy reflection of the spirit being that thought represents. The spirit manifests in man, conditioned by the physical brain organism, but at the same time it has become the inner being of man. Thought is the form that the formless spirit being assumes in man, just as it takes on shape in the plant and soul, just as it takes on shape in the plant and soul in the animal. Consequently, man, insofar as he is a thinking being, is subject to no elementary kingdom, fashioning him from without. His elementary kingdom works in his physical body. Only to the extent that man is shape and sentient being is he worked upon by elementary beings of the same kind as those working upon plants and animals. The thought organism of man is elaborated entirely from within his physical body. In the spirit organism of man, in his nervous system that is developed into the perfect brain, we have sensibly visible before us what works on plants and animals as non-sensory force being. That is, the animal shows self-feeling, but man self-consciousness. In the animal, spirit feels itself as soul. It does not yet grasp itself as spirit. In man, the spirit recognizes itself as spirit, although owing to physical limitations, merely as a shadowy reflection of the spirit, as thought. The threefold world, accordingly, falls into the following categories. 1. Realm of archetypal formless beings, the first elementary kingdom. 2. Realm of shape-creating beings, the second elementary kingdom. 3. Realm of soul beings, third elementary kingdom. 4. Realm of created shapes, or crystal forms, the mineral kingdom. 5. Realm whose forms are sensibly perceptible, and in which the shape-creating beings are active, plant kingdom. 6. Realm whose forms are sensibly perceptible, and in which the shape-creating and soul beings are active, animal kingdom. 7. Realm whose forms are sensibly perceptible, and in which the shape-creating and soul beings are active, and in which the spirit fashions itself in the form of thought within the sense world, human kingdom. From this can be seen how the basic constituents of man living in the body are connected with the spiritual world. The physical body, the ether body, the sentient soul body, and the intellectual soul are to be regarded as archetypes of the spirit land condensed in the sensory world. The physical body comes into existence through condensation of the human archetype to the point of sensory appearance. For this reason, one can call this physical body also a being of the first elementary kingdom, condensed to sensory perceptibility. The ether body comes into existence through the fact that the shape thus engendered maintains its mobility through a being that extends its activity into the kingdom of the senses, but is not itself visible to the senses. If one wishes to characterize this being fully, it must be described as having its origin in the highest regions of spirit land, and thence shaping itself in the second region into an archetype of life. As such an archetype of life, it works in the sensory world. In a similar way, the being that builds up the sentient soul body has its origin in the highest regions of the spirit land, forms itself in the third spirit region into the archetype of the soul world, and as such works in the sensory world. The intellectual soul, however, comes into existence when in the fourth region of the spirit land, the archetype of the thinking man gives itself a thought form in which it acts directly as thinking man in the world of the senses. Thus man stands within the world of the senses. Thus the spirit works on his physical body, ether body, and his sentient soul body. Thus this spirit comes into manifestation in the intellectual soul. Archetypes in the form of beings who in a certain sense are external to man work upon the three lower members of his being. In his intellectual soul, he himself becomes a conscious worker upon himself. The beings who work on his physical body are the same as those who form mineral nature. Beings of the kind that live in the plant kingdom work on his ether body, and those beings such as live in the animal kingdom work on his sentient soul body. I should have said plant kingdom work on his ether body. I don't know if I did. Both are imperceptible to the senses, but extend their activity into these kingdoms. Thus do the different worlds combine in action. The universe man lives in is the expression of this combined activity. 3 asterisks. When we have grasped the sensory world in this way, the understanding opens up for beings of a kind different from those having their existence in the above-mentioned 4 kingdoms of nature. One example of such beings is what may be called the folk or national spirit. This being does not manifest itself directly in a sensibly perceptible way, but lives its life entirely in the sensations, feelings, tendencies, and impulses observable in the common characteristics of a whole nation. This is a being who does not incarnate in the sense world, but just as man forms his body out of substances sensibly visible, so does this folk spirit form its body out of the substance of the soul world. This soul body of the national spirit is like a cloud in which the members of a nation live. Its influences become evident in the souls of the men concerned, but it does not originate in these souls themselves. The national spirit remains merely a shadowy conception of the mind without being or life, an empty abstraction to the man who does not picture it in this way. Something similar may be said in reference to what one calls the spirit of the age, or Zeitgeist. Indeed, the spiritual outlook is extended in this way over a variety of other beings, both lower and higher, that live in the human environment unseen by the bodily senses. Those who have powers of spiritual sight perceive such beings and can describe them. To the lower species of such beings belongs all that is described by observers of the spiritual world as salamanders, sylphs, undines, and gnomes. It should not be necessary to say that such descriptions are not to be considered reproductions of the reality that underlies them. If they were, then the world in question would be not a spiritual, but a grossly sensory one. They are attempts at making clear a spiritual reality that can only be represented in this way, that is, by similes. It is quite comprehensible that anyone who admits the validity of physical vision only regards such beings as the offspring of confused fantasy and superstition. They can, of course, never become visible to the sensory eye because they have no sensory bodies. The superstition does not consist in regarding such beings as real, but in believing that they appear in a way perceptible to the physical senses. Beings of such forms cooperate in the construction of the world, and we come into contact with them as soon as we enter the higher regions closed to the bodily senses. Those people are not superstitious who see in such descriptions pictures of spiritual realities, but rather those who believe in the sensory existence of the pictures, as well as those who deny the spirit, because they think they must deny the sensory picture. Mention must also be made of those beings who do not descend to the soul world, but whose vestment is composed of the formations of spirit land alone. Man perceives them and becomes their companion when he opens his spiritual eye and ear to them. Through such an opening, much becomes intelligible to him that previously he could only stare at uncomprehendingly. It becomes bright around him, and he sees the primal causes of what takes place as effects in the world of the senses. He comprehends that he either denied entirely when he had no... He comprehends what he either denied entirely when he had no spiritual eye, or in reference to which he had to content himself with saying, quote, "There are more things in heaven and earth than are dreamed of in thy philosophy," unquote. People with fine spiritual feelings become uneasy when they begin to have a glimmering, when they become vaguely aware of a world different from the sensory one surrounding them, one in which they have to grope about as the blind grope among visible objects. Nothing but the clear vision of these higher regions of existence and a thorough understanding and penetration of what takes place in them can really fortify a man and lead him to his proper goal. Through insight into what lies hidden from the senses, man expands his nature in such a way that he feels his life prior to this expansion as a mere dreaming about the world. 6. Thought forms and the human aura. See Addendum 13. It has been said that the formations of any one of the 3 worlds can have reality for man only when he has the capacities or the organs for perceiving them. He perceives certain occurrences in space as light phenomena only because he has a correctly constructed eye. How much of what really exists reveals itself to a being depends upon his receptivity. A man, therefore, should never say that what is real is only what he can perceive. Much can be real that he cannot perceive for lack of organs. Now the soul world and the spirit world are just as real as the sensory world. Indeed, they are real in a much higher sense. No physical eye can see feelings and thoughts if they are real. Just as man, by means of his outer senses, has the corporeal world before him as an object of perception, so do feelings, instincts, and thoughts become objects of perception for his spiritual organs. Exactly as occurrences in space can be seen with the sensory eye as color phenomena, so can the above-named soul and spiritual occurrences become, by means of the inner senses, perceptions that are analogous to the sensory color phenomena. To understand fully in what sense this is meant is only possible for one who has followed the path of knowledge described in the following chapter and has as a result developed his inner senses. For such a person, the psychic phenomena in the soul region surrounding him and the spiritual phenomena in the spiritual region becomes supersensibly visible. The feelings of other beings that he experiences ray out to him from them like light phenomena, and thoughts to which he directs his attention surge through spiritual space. For him, the thought of one man about another is not something imperceptible, but on the contrary, is a perceptible occurrence. The content of a thought lives as such only in the soul of the thinker, but this content excites effects in the spirit world. They are the perceptible occurrence to the spiritual eye. The thought streams out as an actual reality from one man and flows to the other. And the way this thought acts on the other person is experienced as a perceptible occurrence in the spiritual world. Thus the physically perceptible man is only part of the whole man, for the one whose spiritual senses are enfolded. This physical man becomes the center of soul and spiritual outpourings. It is impossible to do more than faintly indicate the richly varied world that discloses itself here to the seer. A human thought, which otherwise lives only in the understanding of the listener, appears, for example, as a spiritually perceptible color phenomenon. Its color corresponds with the character of the thought. A thought that springs forth from a sensual impulse in a person has a different color from a thought conceived in the service of pure knowledge, noble beauty, or the eternally good. Thoughts that spring from the sensual life course through the soul world in shades of red. A thought by which the thinker rises to higher knowledge appears in beautiful light yellow. A thought that springs from devoted and unselfish love rays out in glorious rose red. Just as the content of a thought comes to expression in its supersensibly visible form, so also does the greater or lesser degree of its definiteness. The precise thought of the thinker shows itself as a formation with definite outlines. The confused idea appears as a wavering, cloudy formation. In this way, the soul and spirit nature of man appear as the supersensible part of the whole human being. The color effects perceptible to the spirit eye that ray out around the physical man, observed in his activity, and that envelop him like a somewhat egg-shaped cloud, are the human aura. The size of this aura varies in different people, but we may say that the entire man appears, on the average, twice as long and four times as wide as the physical man. The most varied shades of color flood the aura. This color flooding is a true picture of the inner human life. As this changes, so do the shades of color change. Certain permanent qualities, such as talents, habits, and traits of character, however, express themselves also in permanent fundamental color shades. Misunderstandings can arise in men who at present stand remote from the experiences of the path of knowledge described in a later chapter of this book. Misunderstandings in regard to the nature of what is here described as the aura. We might imagine that what are here described as colors would stand before the soul just as the physical colors stand before the physical eye. But such a soul color would be nothing but hallucination. Spiritual science is not in the least concerned with hallucinatory impressions, and they are, in any case, not what is meant in the description now before us. We reach a correct conception if we keep the following in mind. With a physical color, the soul experiences not only the sense impression, but through it, it has a soul experience. When, through the eye, the soul perceives a yellow surface, this soul experience is different from what it is when it perceives a blue surface. One may call this experience living in yellow or living in blue. Now the soul that has followed the path of knowledge has a similar experience in yellow. when observing the active soul experience of other beings, and experience in blue when observing devotional soul moods. The essential thing is not that the seer is The essential thing is not that the seer in a visualization of another soul sees blue just as he sees this blue in the physical world, but that he has an experience that justifies his calling the visualization blue, just as the physical man calls a curtain blue, for instance. Further, it is essential that the seer should be conscious of standing in an experience free of the body, so that he gains the possibility of speaking about the value and the meaning of the soul life in a world whose perception is not mediated through the human body. Although this meaning of the description must be taken into account, yet it is altogether a matter of course for the seer to speak of blue, yellow, green, and so forth in the aura. The aura varies greatly according to the different temperaments and dispositions of people. It likewise varies in accordance with the stages of spiritual development. A man who yields completely to his animal impulses has an entirely different aura from one who lives much in the world of thought. The aura of a religiously disposed nature differs essentially from one that loses itself in the trivial experiences of the day. In addition to this, all varying moods, all inclinations, joys and pains, find their expression in the aura.
We have to compare the auras of various soul experiences with each other in order to learn to understand the meaning of the color shades. To begin with, take soul experiences shot through with strongly marked emotions. They may be divided into two kinds, those in which the soul is impelled to these emotions chiefly by the animal nature, and those in which these passions take a more subtle form, in which they are, so to speak, strongly influenced by reflection. In the first kind of experiences, brown and reddish-yellow streams of color surge through the aura in definite locations. In persons with more subtle passions, there appear in the same locations brighter reddish-yellow and green shades. One can notice that as intelligence increases, the green shades become more frequent. Persons who are very intelligent, but who give themselves over entirely to satisfying their animal impulses, show much green in their aura, but this green will always have an admixture, more or less, of brown or brownish-red. Unintelligent people show a great part of their aura permeated by brownish-red or even by dark blood-red currents. The auras of quiet, meditative, thoughtful soul moods are essentially different from those of such passionate conditions. The brownish and reddish tones become less prominent, and various shades of green emerge. In strenuous thinking, the aura shows a pleasing green undertone. This is to a special degree the appearance of those natures who know how to adapt themselves to every condition of life. Shades of blue appear in soul moods full of devotion. The more a man places his self in the service of a cause, the more pronounced become the blue shades. In this class, also, one finds two quite different kinds of people. There are natures who are not in the habit of exerting their power of thought, passive souls, who, as it were, have nothing to throw into the streams of events in the world but their good nature. Their aura glimmers with a beautiful blue. This is also the appearance of many religious and devotional natures. Compassionate souls and those who find pleasure in giving themselves up to a life of benevolence have a similar aura. If such people are intelligent in addition, green and blue currents alternate, or the blue itself, perhaps, takes on a greenish shade. It is the peculiarity of the active souls, in contrast to the passive, that their blue saturates itself from within with bright shades of color. Inventive natures, having fruitful thoughts, radiate bright shades of color as if from an inner center. This is true to the highest degree in those persons whom we call wise, and especially in those full of fruitful ideas. Generally speaking, all that implies spiritual activity takes more the form of rays spreading out from within, while everything that arises from the animal nature has the form of irregular clouds surging through the aura. The variations in color nuances showing themselves in the corresponding aura formations depend on whether thoughts springing from the soul's activity are at the service of the soul's animal nature or that of an ideal, objective interest. The inventive person who applies all his thoughts to the satisfaction of his sensual passions shows dark blue-red shades. He, on the contrary, who places his thoughts selflessly at the service of an interest outside himself, shows light reddish-blue color tones. A spiritual life combined with noble devotion and capacity to sacrifice shows rose-pink or light violet colors. Not only does the fundamental disposition of the soul show its color surgings in the aura, but also transient passions, moods, and other inner experiences. A violent anger that breaks out suddenly creates red streams. Feelings of injured dignity that expend themselves in a sudden welling up can be seen appearing in dark green clouds. Color phenomena, however, do not appear only in irregular cloud forms, but also in distinctly defined, regularly shaped figures. If we observe a man under the influence of an attack of fear, we see this, for instance, in his aura from top to bottom as undulating stripes of blue color suffused with a bluish-red shimmer. When we observe a person who expects some particular event with anxiety, we can see red-blue stripes like rays constantly streaming through his aura from within outwards. Every sensation received from without can be observed by the one who has developed the faculty of exact spiritual perception. Persons who are greatly excited by every external impression show a continuous flickering of small bluish-red spots and flecks in the aura. In people who do not feel intensely, these flecks have an orange-yellow or even a beautiful yellow coloring. So-called absent-mindedness shows bluish flecks playing over into green and more or less changing in form. By means of a more highly developed spiritual vision, three species of color phenomena can be distinguished within the aura, radiating and surging round a person. Firstly, there are colors that bear, more or less, the character of opaqueness and dullness. Certainly, if we compare them with colors seen with our physical eyes, they appear fugitive and transparent in comparison. Within the supersensible world itself, however, they make the space that they fill, comparatively speaking, opaque. They fill it in the manner of mist formations. A second species of colors consists of those that are light itself, as it were. They light up the space they fill, so that it becomes, through them, itself a space of light. Color phenomena of the third kind are quite different from the first two. They have a raying, sparkling, glittering character. They fill space not merely with light, but with glistening, glittering rays. There is something active and inherently mobile in these colors. The others are somewhat quiet and lack brilliance. These, on the contrary, continuously produce themselves out of themselves, as it were. Space is filled by the first two species of colors with a subtle fluidity that remains quietly in it. By the third, space is filled with an ever self-enkindling life with never-resting activity. These three species of colors, however, are not ranged alongside each other in the human aura. They are not each enclosed in a separate section of space, but they interpenetrate and suffuse each other in the most varied ways. All three species can be seen playing through each other in one region of the aura, just as a physical body, such as a bell, can simultaneously be heard and seen. The aura thus becomes an exceedingly complicated phenomenon because we have to do with three auras within each other, interpenetrating each other. We can, however, overcome the difficulty by directing our attention to the three species alternately. In the supersensible world, we then do something similar to what we do in the sensible. For example, when we close our eyes in order to give ourselves up fully to the impressions of a piece of music, the seer has three different organs for the three species of color, and in order to observe undisturbed, he can open or close any one of the organs to impressions. As a rule, only one kind of organ can at first be developed by a seer, namely the organ for the first species of color. A person at this stage can see only the one aura, the other two remain invisible to him.